For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygen's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
The Dharma of Thusness is intimately transmitted by Buddhas and ancestors. Now you have it. Preserve it well. A silver bowl filled with snow, a hair hidden in the moon. Taken as similar, they are not the same. Not distinguished, their places are known. The meaning does not reside in the words, but a pivotal moment brings it forth. Move and you are trapped. Miss and you fall into doubt and vacillation. Turning away and touching are both wrong, for it is like a massive fire. I guess if I were to give this talk a title, it might be something like Meeting Fire with Fire or Greeting Fire. Many of you will recognize this as the Hokyo Zamai, Song of the Precious Mirror Samadhi, which is a text that some of us are studying this spring as part of the practice commitment period. Some of you who are not familiar with it, if you have chant books, I don't know what page it's on, but it's in there and you might want to refer to it.
It's on page 10.
Page 10. Myself and the other priests, as part of this practice commitment period, have been asked to speak about a line in this teaching poem with the notion of, I believe, of just trying to help open this up to us. And so the line I've chosen is, turning away and touching are both wrong, for it is like a massive fire. And I will be speaking about it, bringing into it a number of other lines, but this is kind of the focus. Just as a note, part of the reason I selected this line is because for the longest time it was essentially the only line in this poem that I could connect to at all. And I connected with it for in some ways the wrong reasons, in the sense that setting aside the Dharma, there are aspects of my own sort of karmic makeup or my composition as a personality or whatever that are a little iffy, a little and dangerous even. I've not dangerous even, like dangerous. I sort of seized onto this line a long time ago as this kind of maxim or a mantra to help me in sort of dealing with these karmic difficulties or whatever. This idea of like, well, you there's a raging fire, be very, very careful, and don't turn your back on it. You're not going to get anywhere that way. And I mention that only because I don't think it's, I'm not going to go much more into that, but it's not separate. Even though I came to this line, and I'm using this line to open up the this poem for myself and hopefully for you, and that I, in a sense, approached it for the wrong reasons, it's still an entry point. And I think that's important, and like you'd keep it in mind in what I go on to say. So the first line of this poem, Hokyo Zamai, the Dharma of Thusness is intimately transmitted by Buddhas and ancestors. So the topic, in a sense, is the Dharma of Thusness. But what I'm most drawn to in this poem more directly comes out of this phrase, intimately transmitted. And I want to talk about this intimate transmission in relationship to fire, the fire that's mentioned here. So, transmission is this very kind of critical term in Zen Buddhism, and it most often is presented to us talking about the the sort of succession from generation to generation through teachers, through Dharma holders, what we call Dharma transmission. And that's part of what this poem is about. But there's transmission in a broader sense, and that's the transmission I'm interested in here. And that has to do with how do we, you know, they've identified this thing, the Dharma of thusness. We can just say the Dharma. How do we receive that? How do we become intimate with it? How is it transmitted to us? How does it become ours? You know, that's it. Well, it'll work. You know, that's the kind of transmission that I'm talking about here. It's the kind of transmission that's going on, you know, in this room as we sit around together this morning. Turning away and touching are both wrong, for it is a massive fire. For it is like a massive fire. This is an interesting image. There's a question for me, or there has been a question for me about, well, what exactly is the it here? What's being referred to? Part of the difficulty is that in the Chinese, there's nothing, no corresponding word. There's just something more like a massive fire. And that's because very frequently subjects are, if they can be understood from context, will not be added explicitly in the sentence. And so there is some question as to what the it refers to. And I think the... There seems to be two main approaches to that. I've heard Taigen, for example, say that the it here is the Dharma of thusness. Another sort of approach is to connect it with the lines that just come before. The meaning does not reside in the words, but a pivotal moment brings it forth. And to see this as sort of a warning about the dangers and liabilities of language. It seems to be, among the things I've seen, sort of a minority view, but given the lack of explicitness, it's reasonable. But I think there's a way, as I've worked with this, and I sort of have gone back and forth in my own mind, I think there's a way to kind of resolve that tension in a satisfactory way. This indicated in the poem itself. Now there are sudden and gradual in which teachings and approaches arise. When teachings and approaches are distinguished, each has its standard. Whether teachings and approaches are mastered or not, reality constantly flows. So, whether teachings or approaches are mastered or not, reality constantly flows. This line suggests to me that there are at least two senses in which this poem is dealing with the term Dharma. The first one is that reality that constantly flows, whether we master the teachings or approaches or not. The Dharma as such. And then there's Dharma also in the sense of teachings and approaches. And when we think of Dharma in this way, can think about the entire apparatus by which we try to encounter the Dharma in this sort of bigger sense. So, teachings and approaches, in which case, you know, we can talk about, well, I mean, for example, the first line, the Dharma of thusness. Is that a different Dharma than Dharma? Or is this a particular way of talking about Dharma, a particular line of inquiry and interaction? And I think that makes a lot of sense. And this, the Dharma of thusness, speaking about it this way, seems to be a part of the sort of treasury of our particular lineage. But it's not this reality that constantly flows, whether you know, we master approaches and teachings or not, it has, it's this other kind of dharma, the dharma, the teaching dharma, the dharma as how, you know, as part of the legacy we've been given of, you know, to work with so that we can meet the dharma on those very sort of intimate personal terms. They're in a sense a medium. And it turns out there are a lot of mediums, media, referred to in this poem. And when I look at it closely, they all seem to have to do with this, you know, have to do with approaches and teachings, this dharma in the second sense. And I think, as I look at it, this may be the way to understand dharma as like a massive fire, as something that's possibly a little dangerous. And of course, thinking about it in those terms and seeing, you know, for example, language as, say, Sheng Yan and Kazutanahashi have it in their translation, it kind of reconciles that separation, right? So, I'll pursue that in just a moment. But going back to this image of the massive fire, that's a little unusual. You know, in Vajrayana Buddhism, in Tantric Buddhism, there's imagery of fire, and it has to do with sort of annihilation of the ego and kind of language they use, and so on and so forth. But our approach, the Soto approach, is a little different, and we're not talking about that kind of negation of the phenomenal self, personhood. So I really don't think it's that. But it is a little, you know, so what is implied by this idea of talking about, you know, if this is indeed the Dharma or words, to talking about that as a massive fire? Why is that dangerous? Touching is wrong. Well, that's what an interesting image, because normally we think, well, we come here and what we're trying to do is completely immerse ourselves in the Dharma. And in some sense, we are doing that. But at the same time, this is saying, no, don't touch. So what is that about? I think it has to do with how we should position ourselves with relationship to all the avenues by which we become intimate with Dharma. The ones that are, you know, it has to do with this, how do we get this intimate transmission? How do we get that relationship? This poem, in one way or another, at least alludes to a number of ways. First of all, we've already seen this question about words, and there are lots of lines in here that have to do with language. Meaning does not reside in words, but a pivotal moment brings it forth. You know, baba wawa, is anything said or not? The word says nothing, referring to a child, for the words are not yet right. There's a line in here about you know, although the Dharma is not constructed, it is not beyond words. So there's language. This is a big question. It's like, you know, there's obviously a generational kind of transmission that there's being talked about in the form of teachers to students. And, you know, an image for that later in the poem has to do with relationships to parents and to so-called social superiors or whatever. So there's language, there's this generational thing, there's reference to institutional arrangements, where they talk about jeweled tables, ornate robes, this kind of thing. And I think we can add to these a kind of cultural transmission, although this is not mentioned in the poem, but, you know, how do we, positioned as we are in 21st century postmodern, post-industrial America, connect to a teaching poem that comes from about 1,000 years ago in China? It's a big question. So I think part of what the poem is suggesting is that the way we do that is very, very carefully. That as Zen students, we are in a very insecure and dangerous place where we have the possibility of getting burned. We've seen this in lots of sanghas around the U.S. lately for different reasons. And it has to do with how people have situated themselves with regard to teachers, with regard to the language of Dharma, with regard to institutions, all of these things. And so as indicated in the poem, it's like, you know, move and you're trapped, miss and you fall into doubt and vacillation, turning away and touching are both wrong, for it's like a massive fire. So what do you do? You're kind of, you got to be right there. You got to be right on the spot. And as Zen students, we can't turn away, or will not be inclined to turn away. I mean, there may be people here today for the first time who get a taste of this and say, well, this is not appealing to me, and they leave. But if you're a Zen student, that's not an option. But then it also says, touching also is wrong. And one avenue, gosh, I'm really going to have to step on it. One avenue of interpretation about this, how people talk about, well, you can't grasp the Dharma, you can't grab onto it, and that, you know, that's worth exploring. But, you know, in fact, in medieval Chinese, they had words for grasping and so on and so forth, and it's not the word they use. They say touching. Likewise, they say not running away. They say turning one's back. So I'd like to take that word touching seriously. And one thing that it suggests to me is maintaining a little distance. So in other words, not turning one's back on the means by which we have the least possibility of meeting the Dharma, but also keeping enough distance so that we do not put ourselves in certain kinds of danger. And in other words, maintaining a critical mind. And this is not a particularly comfortable position to be in. I would suggest, but in fact, it's actually somewhat definitive of what being a Zen student is about. And if you're finding your Zen practice a fairly comfortable thing, you know, you might want to look at it. Suzuki Roshi, for example, once said, "Well, the function of a Zen teacher is to make his students very uncomfortable," and it probably works the other way too. The idea is that, you know, you've got to step forward and you meet, you know, the language, you meet the teacher, you meet the institutional things. And everybody's a little creeped out sometimes by one aspect or another of, you know, organized religion, the institutions. But it suggests that you just can't turn your back, you can't turn your back on it. You have to meet it. So how do you meet it? It has to do with sort of holding your own and being a little bit brave and a little bit persistent, and you know, in the sort of dynamic tension that's created by this situation, there's the possibility that these, what the poem refers to as these pivotal moments, will come forth. The Dharma will manifest itself. Because after all, the Dharma, when we talk about transmission over time, we're not talking about passing a, orange from person to person. The Dharma, there's no such thing as the Dharma of thusness in that sense. There's not a thing there. What there is a the possibility of these pivotal moments that will bring forth awakening and compassion. There are images later in the poem that I think sort of back up this sort of line of interpretation that I'm taking. I'll start with what the right line I've already read. When teachings and approaches are distinguished, each has its standards. Whether teachings and approaches are mastered or not, reality constantly flows. Outside still and inside trembling, like tethered colts or cowering rats, the ancient sages grieve for them and offered them the Dharma. Led by their inverted views, they take black for white. When inverted thinking stops, the affirming mind naturally accords. If you want to follow in the ancient tracks, please observe the sages of the past. One on the verge of realizing the Buddha way contemplated a tree for 10 kalpas. Like a battle-scarred tiger, like a horse with shanks gone gray. Because some are vulgar, jeweled tables and ornate robes. Because some are wide-eyed, cats and white oxen. Okay, if you want to follow the ways of sages, it's saying, I think, you've got to be a bit like a battle-scarred tiger and like a horse with shanks gone gray. I was a little puzzled by this. You get a sense of tiger as this energetic critter with its own sort of ferocity, its own fire, if you will. I was a little perplexed by this. When I first read this thing about horses, it seemed like, I sort of had this image of old Nelly grazing peacefully in the field. But as I looked further into it, horses at this time in China were not a domesticated animal. They were an animal of battle. They were mostly used for military purposes, and as one sort of said, not bred for speed, but bred for strength and endurance, which resonates nicely with Zen practice. So in other words, a horse with shanks gone gray, an old horse, is a horse that's been through a bit, kind of a survivor, if you will. It's like the tiger, an animal of some power of its own, steel, if you will, some courage. And these are contrasted. I never, until very recently, wasn't thinking in these terms, but these other animals that are mentioned are I think, contrasted with these. So, as opposed to, a horse with shanks gone gray, we have, that goes forward, we have a tethered colt, and we have a cowering rat mentioned. And this can be an approach to practice, sort of getting stuck, being tethered, if you will. Or being timid, and likewise, and so maybe if you're the tethered colt sort of practitioner, eventually you, as I say, turn your back, get a little nervous about the fire. The other contrast is sort of on the other side is the horse to the white oxen. Now, the white oxen has its own sort of mythological valences in China, you think of the ox herding pictures and so on. But here, I think contrast is more, the white oxen is very powerful, but it's all, and industrious, but it's also very domesticated and tame. Same with a cat, cats have their qualities, but they're they're not tigers. And, you know, where this is put in, you know, because some are wide-eyed cats and white oxen, you know. So I think this refers to a kind of practice where wide-eyed in the dictionary, the first thing that comes up is refers to uncritical and unsophisticated acceptance of something. And so we see that style of practice where people come to their interactions with the institutions, with the language of Dharma, with their teachers, in an uncritical and unsophisticated way. And that might work for some people, but the poem here seems to suggest, you know, if you want to follow in the path of the ancient sages, you've got to be a little bit more tigerish or horse-like. Likewise, you know, people can approach their practice in a timid way, in kind of a cowering way. They can see security in their practice, et cetera, et cetera. This is all just by way of, you know, of saying, you know, going back to this line about turning away and touching are both wrong, for it is like a massive fire. I think that this partly has to do with if you want to really go forward in practice, and particularly if you do not want to be burned in certain ways, you have to be willing to, one, stay right in that very difficult spot, sort of hold your own ground, but not shy away from engaging with all those other aspects of practice. You know, because this, you know, whole, this creates the environment in which there's the possibility of this kind of intimate, personal, very close transmission of the Dharma to take place, in that broad sense, to take place, for those pivotal moments to occur in which you actually wake up. You know, we see, you know, just to think about this, we, you know, sort of tying some of these things together, you know, we also see kinds of practice, I'll wrap it up here in a minute, Taigen, where people, you know, I mean, I could name you names, people who sort of turned their back because they didn't want to deal with the forms in which Buddhism is transmitted to us. So they develop, well, you know, this is Zen practice, but we're not going to deal with any of this kind of stuff. And then on the other hand, you see people who, you know, and sanghas, where there's this very, like, I don't know what they're trying to do. I mean, it's almost like, you know, if they can just make things as much like medieval China as they possibly can, then that'll solve their issues. And I think this poem suggests no. As Dogen says in Genjo Koan, the place, the way, is never directly transmitted from the past, and neither does it arise in this moment. It's an interaction between these two, and I think that that's what's called for in our relations with forms, with language, with sutras, with robes, with teachers. And part of maintaining this critical distance has to do with maintaining and not surrendering that quality of sort of self-authority, if you will, self-trust. I mean, we talk a lot about, you know, authority in Zen, and I think in some ways maybe a better word is trust, but it's never all on one side. And if you let it be all on one side, you're going to be in trouble. I mean, deeply in the end, you have to have as much trust in yourself as you have in the fire that you're meeting, if you're going to sort of negotiate this sort of tight spot successfully. And yeah, I just think it really that we are called upon as Zen students to keep that in mind, to not become oxen, not to be cats, we've seen many examples lately where sanghas have enabled their teachers in sort of egregious behavior. They certainly weren't doing their own practice a favor. They weren't doing their teacher a favor. They weren't doing Zen a favor. They were doing actually huge damage. I think in some cases it may have had to do with sort of letting their own sort of inherent trust in themselves be, and their capacity to make judgments, be overwhelmed. Seems like I had one more thing to say about that, but it's not coming to mind, so maybe I'll just stop there. And if anybody has any questions or comments, please. Yes?
So I have a question about, the translation, obviously, has a whole layer to it, but just the what you were suggesting as far as preference for being a battle star tiger or a horse with strength gone gray. I didn't quite follow what you were saying as far as because some are wide-eyed cats and white oxen. There's a suggestion not to be like that from the wording. I wasn't also sure about the because word and what that.
Yeah, is. I think this wide-eyedness. I think it has to do with maybe being a little bit too uncritical. Being a little bit naive, and as I said, the animals are referred to have their fine qualities, but I think in the context of this poem, it's sort of saying even though that's fine, it's not really following in the ancient track, so to speak. Hagen.
I appreciate the basic direction of what you said and the aspect of trusting yourself and that sense of maintaining critical judgment and space and trusting yourself as well as trusting the whole situation and the interaction. That specific line, though, because some are wide, having translated that, I think the original has to do with. The sense of being open to wonder. So actually, to offer an alternative interpretation, because there is this possibility of being open to, I think it's contrasting there with because some are common or vulgar or jeweled tables and ornate robes, the fancy accoutrements and the robes and the fancy altarpieces and so forth appeal to or directed to those who are impressed by that, but because some are open, so there's a positive way of reading that line. So I'm not saying that your interpretation is interesting and offers its own value, but because there is this openness to wonder, just the ordinary stuff, so I think there's a positive value, and actually this cats and white oxen goes back to a koan, an old story about Nansen, Joshu's teacher, who said...
Cats and white oxen.
Yeah, so there are lots of... one of the things about reading this text, and this is something that I hope to do in throughout this practice commitment period, is to bring the references in. But one reference that this line has is to the story where Nanchuan said, the Buddhists and ancestors don't know what is. Cats and white oxen know what is.
Yeah, I was...
So there's this sense of this... So an alternative interpretation, and I appreciate, again, the direction that you were going, but for this particular line, the idea is that just ordinary, everyday, the everyday things, that cats and cows know what is. The Buddhists and ancestors don't know just this, just this suchness. So this line also has to do with just trusting everyday, ordinary mind.
Thank you. I'm aware of that that koan, yeah.
So part of what this points out is that this text and these old Zen texts are poetic texts. They're not, you know, didactic texts. And part of what these images offer is that they can appeal to us in different ways, and for us to play with them, as Nyozen has done, to point to aspects of the teaching and aspects of how we can find the Dharma for ourselves is the point. So to use the images, even in translation, to come to what you were basically saying about finding your own trust in your relationship with the teaching, teachers, the whole situation of Dharma is right.
This reminded me of the point that I was trying to locate at the very end. I couldn't get it to. And that has to do with, I just wanted to say that in this engagement, actually, in the engagement practice, that's how that trust develops, both in the tradition as a whole, but also in yourself. I think they arise together in Zen practice. But do you have something, Douglas?
Yeah, I guess I read those two lines as talking about teachings and approaches as skillful means that can be distinguished and to bring people to a realization. The experience of this moment is thusness. To some people, the teaching, we offer a teaching that is jeweled tables and ornate robes.
Exactly.
To the less, I would say, less vulgar, perhaps to the more educated or elegant, we offer cats and flying oxen. And I think that that's part of the critical distance that you talked about several times in this. And from the very beginning, the whole image of the fire is, and it's a different kind of image from traditional Buddhism, where fire is something we're supposed to extinguish.
Yeah.
So the fire is something you don't turn away from it, you don't touch it. It's something that's beneficial. And the teachings are like that too. You don't reject them out of hand, but there is a critical distance about them as well. And I think that's part of your point on the horse with Shanks gone gray and the battle-scarred tiger. These are courageous, powerful animals,
mm-hmm.
but they've got experience now. They sort of step away from a naive approach to this. So the Dharma and teachings are pointers, but the point is not to memorize them or to get caught up in the description or explanation of the Dharma and then ignore the experience of this moment that they're trying to bring you to.
I think the point about skillful means is very, very important. As a matter of fact, in the Shangyan translation, which is the one where he sort of connects that, it, I was talking about to language, he adds this thing, which is actually a total extrapolation. I mean, it's not directly reflected in the text, but it makes the point that you make, where he's speaking of words, he says, you know, it's like a massive fire, useful but dangerous. And that sort of brings up that skillful means aspect.
Just to add about fire, Dogen quotes an old Zen saying, so there is fire in Zen also. Dogen quotes an old Zen saying that all Buddhas sit in the middle of fire. So, you know, there's to take on, you know, as Nyozen was talking about, to take on practicing the way, to take on sitting in the middle of our life and all of the confusion and all of the different aspects of what it's like to try and find our way in this life and find our way in relationship to the Dharma, to this tradition. It's we can't get a hold of it, and yet once we see this possibility, we can't ignore it either. We can't turn away from it. So in some sense, there is this massive fire, and if you're here today, even the people who are here for the first time, somehow you know about it.
This brings to mind two things. I mean, Dogen is a really good example of exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about here in the sense that, you know, I didn't want to get involved with it, but part of what's going on in this poem has to do with the Soto teaching of the five ranks. You can read about it in Taigen's forthcoming book. You know, so that's, you know, so that's part of what this kind of what do you call it, canonical Soto Zen poem is about. And, you know, Dogen, you know, basically says, well, you know, this language, this doesn't really work for me. And he takes a different approach. Also, speaking of fire, one of the things I'll just point out, if fire makes another appearance in this poem, in the reference to the illumination hexagram, which has been a great puzzle for me, and it has to do with this hexagram from the I Ching, and it's talking about the sort of transformative process, et cetera, et cetera. But I realized, looking into it, that the illumination hexagram is composed of two fire trigrams. It's a double fire. And so I think that part of, you know, this, in talking about the transformation, they're talking about that image of, you know, as I indicated with the title, meeting fire with fire. I mean, you've got to... Mm-hmm. And that's where the light comes from, the illumination.
I thought both Roy and Joan had their hands up, but I want to say one thing about skillful means first. Which is that you were talking about, you know, in this line about sometimes jeweled tables and ornate robes, sometimes cats and white cows. As a teacher, it's not that, you know, certain people get one and certain people get the other. In any given situation, with one person, you know, oh hey, today you need in this situation you need, you know, fancy tables and ornate robes, and some other time when I see you, you know, cats and white cows. So it's not like, you know, you're either one person or the other person. It's like, it's very much, well, what is it right now? So I just wanted to say that.
A whole bunch of people.
I'm all good.
Joan?
I found myself wondering with these lines about the fire, don't touch it, don't turn it away, if that could refer to all the phenomena of our lives. And if we touch it, we might be grasping, we might be holding on to it, getting stuck in it. But if we turn it away, then we're in denial of it, we're not paying any attention to it.
Right.
Yeah, well, the quote from Dogen really summed up what I was thinking about this, and kind of a question of, is it really kind of the image that I got from you was, there's this fire out here, don't turn away from it, don't turn towards it. And I wonder if you can't think of it more as, you know, like the Buddha said, the whole world is on fire. So we're already in the middle of it. There is nowhere to turn. There is no grasping of it. There's no touching of it. We're part of that fire as well. And so I wonder if it's really, to some degree, saying there's nothing fixed there for you to touch anyway. Hmm. And so the minute you think, okay, here's the teaching, I'm going to write it down, you've already defiled it, because that might have been the teaching for you a moment ago. But that the Dharma of thusness has to be this constant shifting reality as it is in this moment. And even the concept of in this moment can be something we
grasp.
Can't touch.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good point. I mean, there's a line here later where, talking about language, was anything said or not? In the end, it says nothing, for the words are not yet right. And in a sense, that echoes the point you're making, because the words are never quite right. They're never going to be quite right. You have to come to terms with things and find ways of thinking about things and all that in an ongoing kind of way. But just as Taigen was sort of saying, you know, when he works with students from day to day, he's sort of meeting different people, and from day to day, we are called upon to generate a sort of fresh response to all the phenomenal world, and speak about it with fresh language. We just can't, you know, get it down. We can't, again, to echo what you're saying, we can't grasp it. We can't get it nailed down once and for all. It's always this dynamic process. And that's why I was sort of wanting to emphasize in the first line the intimately transmitted rather than the subject of that.
Yeah, thank you. So actually, we'll have time for conversation, but it's sort of getting to be time. But just, if I may, in closing, just following up on what Nyuzhan said, the point is that it's not about reaching some understanding or getting a hold of something at all. It's that how do we sustain an attention and awareness, and new stuff is always coming to light. How do we meet that?
As you said.
And so we have to... it's an ongoing attention, sustaining our practice and sustaining our gaze.